Welcome back to another week, another month of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, editors, production designers, costume designers, sound gurus, VFX artisans, sound editors, sound mixers, composers. We just talk to everybody. And we're going to do a bunch of talking today. Got to make up for last week. You know, took the week off. Hope everybody had a great 4th of July week and saw some movies. One of which I hope was Kevin Costner's Horizon and American Saga Part 1. Wow. I had great trepidation about this film, but I've got to tell you, it is an epic masterwork. The authenticity reigns supreme. The locations are to die for. You think of John Ford, John Huston, Monument Valley. This is equally, if not more, beautiful with the gorgeous vistas that Costner gives us. And all of the imagery, it just is exquisite from a storytelling standpoint. The camera work is award-worthy. The visual grammar with Dutching, widescreens, close-ups, everything is used purposefully and to their best advantage. Lighting embraces the natural sunlight and shadows, while night shoots and candlelight are just stunning, stunning. The editing is fantastic, especially when you get into the third act and there is this frenetic sequence at the end of the third act montage that is to die for. Absolutely to die for. Casting is great. Of course, we get Costner. Not a whole lot of Costner in this one. I think we'll see more Costner in part two. But we've got Luke Wilson, Sienna Miller. Yellowstone fans will be happy to see Will Patton and Danny Huston pop up. Sam Worthington. Sam Worthington and Sienna Miller are wonderful in this. The action is intense, particularly in the first act and again in that third act final sequencing, which is fantastic. The costuming. I am so in love with the costuming on this film. You know, Costner is known for authenticity and attention to detail, and that trickles down through all of the department heads and their teams, and costuming really stands out, and the imagery is so strong. You can see the fibers of the fabrics within all of the fabrications. You see the natural fibers, the nubbiness. You see some silk. Silk was a common fabric of the rich and the upper classes in the 1800s. But just stunning. The Native American wear, including the jewelry, is beautiful. Here again, it's just every element. But what really brings it all home, ties us together, and makes the real magic of this film is John Debney's score. Wow. The score itself and the orchestration. As soon as the film started and I started hearing elements of the score and looking at the visuals, I immediately flashed back to elementary school in the early 1960s when we were shown a Disney live-action short documentary called The Grand Canyon Suite. And it was the imagery of the Grand Canyon set to the famous Grand Canyon Suite, which is a composition that is just to die for. Absolutely to die for. It is so beautiful. And we feel that made me fall in love with documentaries, in all honesty, that in Beaver Valley when I was in elementary school. But that particular, it's a 30-minute short documentary directed by John Algar. Beautifully done. But it is the five-movement suite, musical suite. And that is immediately what I thought of with the structuring of Horizon and with Debney's score here. And as you go through and watch the film, you hear different movements. In addition to motifs, you hear different orchestral movements within the 3 hours. Just absolutely outstanding. If Debney, if Horizon, Costner do not get award nominations this season, there is no justice. Particularly with Debney in Best Original Score. Just outstanding. But I love the influence that obviously came from the Grand Canyon Suite itself. And if you guys haven't seen the short film or listened to the beautiful, beautiful live recording that was done of Eugene Ormandy leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in the Grand Canyon Suite, look it up on YouTube because it's a real treat. But I mentioned that key word, 3 hours and 1 minute. I got to tell you, as soon as this film ended, I wanted more. It never felt like 3 hours. It moved along quickly, smartly, intelligently. And I was invested from beginning to end. And as soon as it ended, I wanted to see part two. August 16th, I think, is the release date for Horizon American Saga Part 2. I wish August 16th was right now because I am ready for the next part. So if anybody has been put off and has not gone to see the film, do yourself a favor. Go. It is well worth it. And hey, we're having a heat wave across the country. Theaters, air conditioned, free. So there's my weather tip and my movie going tip for you this week. And hopefully everybody's been checking out Thelma. Just a fabulous, fabulous film. And it is so much fun. And I'm just so tickled to see June Squibb as our new action hero this year. But you talk about fun films. Well, these two films we're going to talk about today may not exactly be deemed as fun, but they are definitely interesting films. Joining us at the midpoint of the show is going to be is director, co-writer, cinematographer, camera operator, Brian Johnson, talking about his new film, Population Purge. It releases tomorrow, July 9th, digitally. It is an interesting, interesting film, to say the least. A dystopian world, a radical government unleashed a deadly poison to control the population. And the only people that aren't affected by this are people with AB blood type. AB positive blood type, mind you. It's interesting. The locations are outstanding. All these haunted, abandoned places in North and South Carolina. So I'm very excited that we're going to be able to talk to Brian about this at the midpoint of the show. But first, a powerful film, a thriller that is chilling. Boneyard. This is actually based on the as yet unsolved crime of the West Mesa Bone Killer and the West Mesa murders that occurred from 2001 to 2005, where 11 women were buried in what became known as the West Mesa Boneyard. The skeletons were discovered in 2009. That is the premise for Boneyard. And writer-director he's co-writer, but director and co-writer Asif Akbar brought so much life into this true crime story, turning it into a narrative. But what I love about what Asif has done, it's you have the reality-based story, and he tackled the challenges of grounding the film in the realism, but also making it cinematic and at the same time paying homage and being very respectful and humanizing these women, these victims. You can go online and learn more than you ever wanted to know about this serial killer. Rumors have abounded for years, sex trafficking involved, because a lot of the women of these 11 women were prostitutes. Were drugs involved? Were the Mexican cartels involved? So many possibilities. But as I said, the crimes are still unsolved in New Mexico. But outstanding cast. Brian Van Holt, who plays a local detective. His partner, played by Nora Zehetner. They're the two local cops in New Mexico investigating. Their chief is played by Curtis Jackson. We have another cop involved as well, who, shall we say, is less than forthright and upstanding, played by Randall Barron. Weston Cage pops up, as does Gail O'Grady, and a highlight for me, Mel Gibson as the FBI profiler who is brought in on this. As comes as no surprise, Mel brings an intensity that is riveting. The story structure is quite interesting because there is so much ambiguity, because the crimes have been unsolved. There's a lot of room to play as to who might be responsible, who may not be responsible. Certain of the crimes, they're hypothetical in how they occurred. But Asif, along with his cinematographer, Joshua Reese, who does an amazing job, sticks with light, bright, harsh lighting. Metaphorically, there's no cover-up happening here. The lighting exposes everything. The only time we get darkness is what we see within each character, as well as in the crimes themselves that are happening. R.J. Cooper, known for his work in a lot of the Bruce Willis low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget films near the end of Bruce's acting career, things like Fortress, Survive the Game, Hard Kill, Survive the Night, Trauma Center. R.J. knows how to keep you on your toes, knows how to find a balance while keeping you off balance. It's very interesting, and he plays with Joshua's camera work beautifully. So everybody is off kilter because nobody can get a handle on this serial killer and these crimes. It is a really, it's a powerful film. And for Asif, this, it's very important because he's, to him, he is giving voice to one of the most heinous crimes that happens the world over. And that is all these missing women and children. And so many are tied to sex trafficking. Number of years ago, Deion Taylor did a film that addressed missing women and the idea of sex trafficking, called Traffic, with a K at the end. But this, the fact that this is premised upon real-life investigations, a real-life serial killer, and the crime has not been solved, it adds a whole other layer of creepy and chilling. So, instead of me prattling on and on about a film I clearly like, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Asif Akbar talking about Boneyard.
Hello, Debbie. How are you?
Hi, Asif. I am very excited to be talking with you about Boneyard.
Thank you, likewise.
I watched it the other night as soon as Emma got me a link, and I was glued.
Wow, thank you. That means a lot.
To the screen. It's number one, I love films that are based on true events and true crime and something like this. And I remember when the West Mesa incident was all over the news everywhere because it was so heinous. And nobody has ever tackled this particular crime or crimes, shall we say. So I was happy to see that as a basis for Boneyard. But more than that, to see how you and your co-writer, as Vincent, the way that you have designed this and structured this, you throw ambiguity on so many people. Right. You have we are wondering the entire time, especially when something gets thrown in the mix about dirty cops and cartels and things like this. So there is enough suspicion to go around everywhere. And it's only through breadcrumbs that you dig a lot of people out of this potential hole that they may be in terms of culpability with these crimes. And that structure is so well done, and you dig them out of these holes with flashbacks that we really get their motivation. One of the strongest ones is Mel's character of Agent Petrovic. And that really sets a tone for his character. And we
with
see...
the daughter, yeah, thank you. Thank you. And it's interesting enough, that was a character piece that I literally threw in like about a week before we were shooting. I felt like there was something that was missing for Mel's motivation and, you know, to really showcase his loss as well. And... you know, that's something we kind of threw together, and Mel was a trooper, and he, you know, went along with it, and it all came, you know, out pretty well. We're all happy with it. Even Mel, when we were doing ADR, he watched it, and he said, great job. And, you know, it's a blessing to work with talent like that, and then to, you know, be able to collaborate and do something nice and that works. And thank you, Debbie, for... you know, everything you just said about how you felt watching it. And I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, I really appreciate the fact that you got the message and could, you know, really recognize the different layers. And like you said, the breadcrumbs that, you know, we leave with the audience kind of picking up and you know, learning something more, which was a reflection of how the real life case or, you know, cases that are similar to these types of serial killer cold cases. I mean, there are so many questions and so many suspects and so many directions that you look. I mean, even in the police departments, I mean, there's different layers throughout the different departments that handle the different cases, you know, the different types of criminal cases. There's homicide, there's, you know, all kinds of different departments that are intertwined at the end of the day, too. And it's so easy for, you know, someone within their own department to be corrupt and, you know, interfere. So there's like so many different layers and variables we normally don't think about when we watch serial killer movies. It's usually that the straightforward, oh, the FBI and the detective chasing after the killer, and they find the killer and now they gotta stop him. But here I wanted to, you know, bring the realism to the screen and to the audience's feelings of what these cases represent and the, like, the real true mystery and the tension and you know, the struggles that goes on with not only the families of the victims and the victims themselves, but also the law enforcement individuals that you know, spend day and night and their lives and everything, you know, to try and solve these cases. And in this particular case, you know, they never really found the killer. But they have solved many other cases that were serial killer cases or murder cases or, you know, abduction cases, missing persons. Mm-hmm. These are real life issues that we deal with. And for this film, we were inspired by many of these cases and these stories, not only the West Mesa incident, but that was one that we were heavily influenced, you know, by and were inspired, you know, to write the script and kind of center that case around the whole story. But when you watch the movie, as you have, it represents many different kinds of serial killer cases that are very similar, and it's an educational piece where, you know, we're trying to teach the audience and make them aware of, you know, this issue. To me, it's a global, you know, social issue, and one of the more, you know, horrific things that could ever happen is to come across evil like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and something that you also do that is so key is it. You humanize the victims. They are not dismissed as just being hookers or involved in drugs or anything. You put a face to the victims. And I think that's very, very important here because it humanizes it and it also invests the audience even more. And it works really, really well the way you have done that. And I commend you on doing that. And that structure point. Now, something that you do, your visual grammar here, I love. You've got Joshua Rees as your DP. The cinematography, the lighting and the lensing. We've got a lot of traditional shots, but then a lot of shots that are skewed, dutched. So you vary that. We feel the confusion. We feel the frustration that Petrovic and Ortega and Carter, that they're all going through. As to we're not getting a break, you know, we got to come after this guy. And then in the hypothetical sequences, since nobody was there in real life to see what was happening to these girls at the moment of murder, you really, Joshua does an incredible job with the camera work, especially in the SUV, things like that. But otherwise, you keep it light, bright, harsh light, the exterior light. It's that harsh desert light. That also, it's like overkill, and it blinds you, very metaphorically as to the blinding that the serial killer, the obfuscation that's happening with the crimes themselves. But it tells us also there's no cover-up. You keep it light and bright. The light, it metaphorically, it exposes everything so that then the only darkness that we're getting is from within the demons within each of our principles, be it guilt over a daughter being killed, be it guilt over another family member, be it something untoward that happened in the course of work. That showcases, I love that distinction in how you use the visual grammar to tell that aspect of the story.
Thank you, Debbie. I really appreciate that you were able to understand the details. And then, and you're right, we were very careful in designing each of those scenes with the particular lighting and also the kind of camera lens, you know, we use for specific scenes. Some scenes we've used zoom lenses, and then like some scenes, you know, we shot very traditional. And then, you know, it helped not only define each of the characters and their backstories and what they're going through, but also the mood and the tension of the moment in the scene. And again, it goes back to me kind of staying more with the realism style of the story and to make the audience feel like, you know, they're always uncomfortable, you know, at certain times, even with the, you know, the lit up, you know, scenes or the dark scenes, you're always kind of in an uncomfort zone. And also, I mean, being in that environment in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I feel like, you know, we were definitely able to capture what it really looks like, especially in that time period as well.
Now, did you shoot in Albuquerque in the general area?
We actually did our principal photography all in Las Vegas. We did have a couple days of, like, you know, B-roll, second unit stuff to establish Albuquerque, but we actually shot most of the whole film in Las Vegas, and it doubled pretty well.
It really does. And, of course, you get the same meridian light level. So, it for Joshua, you know, setting the lighting and the LUTs and all, it was going to be the same whether you'd be in Albuquerque or in the Vegas area, because we've got that same meridian sunlight. But,
yeah, same landscape and everything. I mean, even, you know, the police department out of Albuquerque reached out to us recently after seeing the trailer just to verify and confirm if we shot there or not in their own police department, because they said the conference rooms and everything that we showed looked so identical to the real thing that they were confused themselves if we really shot. They were like, well, we don't remember giving you guys permission. And we're like, well, we didn't shoot there. So they were surprised. So that was a compliment, I guess.
That's a compliment. A very critical element to Boneyard is R.J. Cooper's editing. How challenging was the editing process on this? Because you're balancing so many different characters, their backstories, which contribute to their present day behaviors. You're integrating crimes. You're integrating the girls, and it's a juggling act as you're parsing out bits and pieces to us. But at the same time, you're also trying to ground this film in realism and truth, but still make it cinematic.
Yes.
Were you and RJ pulling your hair out with this one?
That, you know what, you kind of hit it right on the head. The editing process on this film, and this particular film out of, you know, all the films that I've done now so far, probably was definitely the most challenging, because of bringing all those elements together and trying to keep it real and also cinematic, and then telling all these people's stories in an hour and a half. The editing process was our longest phase in making this film, and we went through, you know, countless versions of the cut before we finally had picture lock. But you're right, I mean, it was you know, that definitely was the most challenging, I would say, but it was also the most fun to bring in that story together and structuring it.
You know, for a film like this, how does it weigh on you as a producer, as a director, as a writer, as a storyteller, the fact that the onus that you feel in making sure there is the truth stays at the core of this, rather than turning it into entertainment, pure entertainment? Because these are real women, real lives that we're talking about, real surviving family members that may go see this film. And you don't want to disrespect them. So I'm curious about how that affects you when you approach a film like this.
Well, you know, I also have a documentary background as well in my early on in my career. Mm-hmm. So I almost approached this as if I was making a documentary, like a docufilm, where it is, a you know, inspired from true crime stories, and these are serious matters. It's not just even any other story. It's, you're playing with people's livelihoods and legacies, and you know, and emotional. Probably the most emotional, you know, connection there with any human audience. And I had to really look at it like this is an awareness piece, and I'm doing this for my part of why I became a filmmaker, to send out a message that makes a difference. And so I went about it as you know, as I'm telling true stories, like a documentary, but in a cinematic format. So that helped me taking it seriously. And I never want to glorify this subject matter as just entertainment. Obviously, for cinematic purposes, you have to have a story and that structure. But at the end of the day, I want people to use this as an educational tool and be aware of the horrors of these cases and what people go through. So hopefully, you know, we've done our job on that part.
And I can't tell you, I'm not going to say who it is or where it is, but I love the cameo FBI investigator that shows up late in the film. Her name is not listed anywhere. But
oh, Gail O'Grady, yeah, she's wonderful.
So we're not keeping it a secret?
No, it's okay. Not a secret. But yeah, no, she's a great actress. But that was part of, her role's not as big, but she brings another, female perspective to the case as well. And it also shows the different layers that are also within, the FBI,
yeah,
and then the different layers that are within the local police department, and and all the politics in there. So it just shows the reality of some of those situations.
Yeah, I didn't know if we were keeping her appearance a secret or not, because I was just tickled to have her show up. And like you said, the female perspectives, because Gail's work and that of Nora's, so we get the FBI and we get the detective level. We get both levels of the female gaze.
Yeah, they're both in a man's world. And in real life, that's what it was, too. And, in most of these cases, it's a male-dominating world in law enforcement. So sometimes, you have to have the female voices, like even in the interrogation. Sometimes, girls that are being interrogated, they would feel more comfortable talking to a female or saying something in front of a female. And we have that in the movie.
Definitely.
The difference between them getting interrogated by the female detective and the male detective or the female FBI agent. And so, yeah, there's definitely realism there as well.
Just on every level, Asif, this Boneyard is so well done.
Thank you, Deb. I'm so glad, and I appreciate that you understood and were able to take this feeling away from the movie.
And I've seen some of your other films, so to see this one really speaks, I think, more to you and your psychological approach as a director, the storytelling of Boneyard, than some of your other films in the past. And I love to see that growth in a filmmaker, and I definitely see it here with you.
Thank you so much, Debbie. That means the world to me. Thank you.
Asif, thank you so much. I can't wait to see what you bring me next, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Yes, same here, and I'm working on actually a docuseries based on the real West Mesa murders story, so that'll be interesting, but we'll be able to tell the, real case stories.
Okay, that's now on my radar. I'm going to be looking for that.
All right, thank you, Debbie.
Thanks,
Asif. Great chatting with you.
And that was Asif Akbar, the director and co-writer of Boneyard. It is available right now. I know it's on cable because it's on Spectrum. So definitely check it out. It's on digital streaming as well. Popped out on there on July 2nd. And it's in some select theaters in the U.S. right now that opened in theaters on Friday. So give it a look. It's intense, it's interesting, and it's a very, very well done film. Now we're going to switch gears here. And going from serial killer to the government killing people. And a big welcome to Brian Johnson. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm just fine. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic. Just bear with me. I'm actually in the car going from point A to point B. I'm on another project, so.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Yeah, so hopefully we won't get disconnected.
Hopefully. Well, I get Population Purge. This is an interesting film, but I have to say, given the current political climate in the United States, it makes me wonder, This could be a possibility. My gosh.
That's exactly what I was thinking when we put it together.
Oh,
I'm like, you know, yep. See, I had that in the back of my head going, we can, this is our marketing ploy, you know? Real life.
You know, dystopian world, a radical government, unleashing a poison to control the population, and the only way you survive is if you have blood type AB positive. Yeah. And that's a small percentage of the population with AB positive.
Right. Welcome to life.
And the fact that then instead of dying, well, right away, well, then you're just left to suffer until then you die.
Right.
But in the meantime, for people that are clamoring to get the AB positive blood to stay alive, we've got chaos. We've got panic. We've got insurrection. We've got everything happening.
We've got it all.
It is just the whole premise. When did you come up with this idea for this?
Actually, it was about 3 years ago.
Look at that timing.
Exactly. Who would have known?
Sometime after January 6th of 2021?
Yeah, somewhere about that time. And actually, it was going to be, we were going to shoot a teaser just to do the actual, you know, to raise money to do the film. And the teaser soon turned into the feature. So we decided, you know, I decided to go ahead and just put the money up myself to go ahead and turn it from a teaser to a feature. I've been in the business for 30 plus years as a cinematographer. So, you know, I had the logistics I already had. So I teamed up with this writer guy, and I said, you know what, let's just push this. If it takes us 2 years to make it, we'll make it happen. And we did.
And little did you realize the state the country would be in now.
I had no idea. Really, seriously, I had no idea. I never thought that. I never thought that. So what I would love to have happen is once this comes out, I would love to have a part two to bring everything up to date as it is today. Now, that would be absolutely phenomenal.
Well, you may want to wait till after November 5th to do that.
Well, yeah. Yeah. We may have people throwing money at us.
You might. Well, you know, everybody can see population purge starting tomorrow.
Exactly. I'm like, you know, I always say, I mean, I have to say this is probably the biggest low budget film I've ever been on or ever obviously ever produced, but so, you know, even for a low budget film, you know, we've got the backdrops, we've got the characters, we've got a lot going on. You know, a team came together, and we just made it happen.
Wow. Well, now let's dig into Population Purge. You know, we've got our story set for our listeners, but I've got to tell you, one of the most fascinating elements of the film are your locations. You know, everybody talks about real estate, location, location, location. No. For Population Purge, it's all about location, location, location. You shot this in abandoned amusement parks. You shot in Panic Attack Haunted Park in North Carolina, Fort Apache Junkyard. Yep. I mean, come on. You got to have a good junkyard in a dystopian world.
I didn't want to attempt this until I had the perfect backdrop.
The backdrop, the locations are everything in this film. They are everything, Brian.
That's what I was going for. I was, you know, like I said, you know, I came from being in the business for over 30 years as a cinematographer. So I said, I cannot go backwards when it comes to the visuals. I said, I cannot do it. So I got out and found these places and, you know, and talked to the people, the owners, and we worked out deals. And next thing you know, we were shooting there. So
just the locations are everything here. And then the way that you shoot them, because you're a cinematographer and you're also the camera operator and you're the director. So this truly is your vision from beginning to end. And I have as people watch this, and because our main characters, we have an older man, Charlie. His granddaughter, Maya, lives with him. His wife, she lives in what is the town. But Charlie and Maya live at an abandoned amusement park. Were those scenes shot in the Nightmare Factory?
They were shot, that particular scene with those two, that was shot at Fort Apache.
At the junkyard.
There's a story there beyond all stories, beyond the film. I mean, the location itself has a backstory. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. The gentleman that owns that, this sounds like a character right out of a horror film. He lives inside that junkyard in a little cabin. When movies are shot in the area of like Wilmington, North Carolina, and areas like that, a lot of the props, when they're through, go to his. He takes them and puts them out back in his junkyard. So there's props everywhere there. Mm-hmm. There's all these. The relics. It's unimaginable what's there. It's crazy.
Well, we see a lot of it on screen in Population Purge.
Exactly.
You did not have to do any set dress here, clearly.
Oh, my gosh, we did not. Exactly. Everything was laid out for us.
But now, you've also got some really great horror elements happening here. Because we, of course, have our government overlord, the district warden, Onslow, who is played by S. Lamar Wilson. And I swear, he looks like a cross between Rasputin and Charles Manson.
He is a fantastic actor. He did a lot of shows back in the 80s, and now he's a performer. He plays a pirate. Dolly Parton has a show called Pirates Voyage. That's one of those the live dinner theater shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the main character, the actual pirate. Been doing it for 13 years.
Well, he is, as Onslow, as our district warden, he is positively creepy. And
I'm telling you.
And as soon as he was on screen, I immediately thought of the mad monk Rasputin. Then as he starts talking and raving, then I'm thinking, because we didn't hear Rasputin speak. We've only seen images and things or read text.
Right.
But then he's talking and it's like Charles Manson. So, it's like, okay.
And the wildest thing is, he is the sweetest guy you'll ever meet. He's such a sweetheart. He is opposite of what he looks like.
Isn't that always the way, though? Isn't that always the way?
Yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, if you met him, you'd be like, wait a minute, this is not the character I see. He's fantastic. He's wonderful.
And, you know, his big thing is, number one, he wants to maintain control over everything as the district warden. And there are all these weird rules that the government now has put into place. You know, if you hit the age 80 and you're not dead yet, well, we're going to kill you.
Right.
Now, if you're AB positive, we're not taking your blood if you're under 18 or something. You have to be of age in order for us to take your blood. Or if you're trying to escape government intervention, you can take your own blood and sell it on the black market, essentially. This is a situation we find Charlie in. He's elderly, but he's still very spry. Might have a few little mental quirks happening here.
There's no question.
And then his granddaughter, Maya, she worries about him. She lives with him. And she is more or less trying to be a vigilante in her own right to fight off the scalpers who are the people that want to come after those that are pure AB positive and get their blood for their own nefarious purposes.
Right, exactly.
So it's, you know, we've got all this happening. I really love Peter Holland in this role as Charlie.
I really
like him in this role as Charlie.
He's a great character.
And I love the surroundings and how he goes into these and to keep himself entertained, he puts on performances, he puts on makeup and costumes and travels all through this abandoned junkyard abode of theirs. Scares the bejeebus out of his own granddaughter.
He's in his own little world.
Yeah, but this is where your camera work really comes into play, Brian. You've got some really narrow corridors in there. You've got walls, obviously they're dummied up, that look like old stone walls or granite.
Sure.
But they're narrow corridors, and you're traveling through there. In many of these cases, you're dollying backwards. You're traveling backwards with the actors coming at you. Really nicely done.
I appreciate that.
And then when we're out, you know, we're outside a lot, too, as Charlie makes his trek to Jade, the woman in the bayou or wherever that he sells his blood to in exchange for gold, because apparently money is no good. You got to have gold. And who's coming after him? And he doesn't realize his granddaughter is tagging along because, you know, she's like a Katniss Everdeen with the way she uses a bow and arrow.
And, I love that character.
And she's going to protect her grandfather
as
he goes off alone, which she never thinks he should do. But then she also needs protecting because she gets herself in compromising situations with scalpers coming after her. And all of that you very nicely package into montages. And I think that works really well, Brian. Those montages work really well. There's, you know, nobody's talking except maybe one word here or there. We do have an incredible reveal spoiler that we're not giving away. in terms of Maya, but
thank you so much.
I like how you've broken it down. So we get those close-ups, we get the claustrophobic, feel for Charlie in his cloistered little world. Then we have the wider open spaces that Maya wants to be in, but she really is not totally equipped to be in them on her own. And the fact you contrast and have the dialogue happening with most of the dialogue happening within the confines of the abandoned junkyard, whatever, where Charlie lives, and you doing montages for the outside. I like that visual distinction, that emotional distinction.
Right, because that's exactly what I had intended to do. I'm one that you don't have to have dialogue all the time, inside, outside, and everywhere you go. You know, let the audience feel for a while emotionally.
Yeah, no, but the purposeful distinction between the two different kinds of scenarios I really like. So you really let us get into Charlie's head, such as it is. And the scalpers are scalpers are scalpers. They're more or less a kind of mercenary. So we really we don't need to hear from them. And then we've got, you know, we have Onslow bubbling over here when his son gets sick and needs to be saved. So, and that adds another dynamic into the mix. So you've got a lot going on, but you really, the visuals tell so much of this film.
My whole intention. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Once you establish your parameters in the beginning of the film, you really let the visuals take over.
Yeah.
And it works to your advantage here. It really does. Because nobody, I don't know about anybody else when they watch this film tomorrow, after it releases, but I think they're going to be fascinated with your different locations and looking at the different signage and looking at the now dead neon, you know, marquees and things that are lying around. That's half the fun, is to see to see what existed in the world before this radical government takeover and destruction. You know, how long did it take you to shoot this? Because you do have multiple locations, and the intricacy of some of this, some of the action sequences. Yeah, a couple of them you can tell they're like kind of fake punches being thrown, but it still works.
Right, exactly.
Which is why the montage also makes it look better.
Right, exactly.
How long did this shoot take you?
The amount of days was about 35 to 40 days. But it was spread out over probably about 8 months.
Now,
we had to work around a lot of schedules, so.
Well, you've got your actor's schedules. Did you have trouble getting these locations? Were all of these owners happy to comply?
They bent over backwards for me.
And you're very lucky there. Now, I'm thinking on the river and all, you didn't really need any permissions there, or did you?
No. The boat and the guy driving the boat, he owns that boat and owns, like, land on the river.
Oh.
That land is his. So he said, let's do it. I'll drive the boat. You got anything you need.
And that's why he doesn't talk, because if he talked, he would get a higher pay rate.
Exactly.
People don't realize that. You can have extras come in, but the minute they start talking, that costs you more money.
So, exactly.
But
I told him to keep his mouth shut.
And he did.
Yeah.
He did. Sunglasses on, beanie cap on. Yeah. Yep. I mean, looked like one of the good old boys from the hills.
Exactly, and he knew the river well because he travels that river up and down. So,
wow. What was the most challenging aspect of this production, Brian?
The most challenging film. I mean, I'm sorry. The most challenging aspect of the movie. You know, I can't. There's really not one challenge versus another challenge, really. They're all about the same even keel for me. It went smoothly. There was nothing like a great challenge as far as you're trying to take on, logistics or anything else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A long time editing. I'm also an editor, so I edited the film. And it took me about a year to edit.
Talk to me about editing this. Did you wait until you had all your footage assembled?
I did.
Okay, so you weren't doing piecemeal editing as you went, thinking, oh, God, I need more pickups here. I need this, that, or the other.
Well, we did. Once I went through all the footage, once we wrapped, and I did see we needed some additional footage. Went back and shot a bunch of B-roll and some additional scenes. Once I saw we needed some extra stuff, so. I'm shooting other. I couldn't. And the reason why I didn't start piecemealing it because I'm shooting other films as well, other people's films. So, as a cinematographer, I'm working, so I didn't get a chance to just drop mine. I mean, stay on mine, so I had to drop it and go to their films, that kind of thing.
Yes, but you have to go do their films in order to pay for your own film.
You got that right.
So
that's exactly right.
I get how that works. I get how that works. What were the considerations you had in the editing process? You know, in finding balances or deciding what to put in, what to include, doing this montage versus, straightforward.
Well,
in camera.
That just comes from my background. I've always been an epic type person from a cinematography standpoint. I've mm-hmm. always wanted. I love epic, and I love epic music. The scoring and the broad epicness of film has always been me on everything I've worked on. So that's what I was trying to bring to the table, a little balance of a little bit of, dialogue, scenes, and then emotionals through the montages and the music and, all of that. As opposed to just, I've never liked dialogue back-to-back, constant dialogue, mm-hmm. Because after a while, it gets boring.
Yes, it does.
I'm big on music, so I try to...
Uh-oh, I think we lost you there, Brian. Oh, you're back.
Hello?
I hear you now. We lost you there for a minute.
Yep. Yeah, I'm back.
You were talking about the music.
I was just saying, music is equally as important as the visuals, so that's why I tried to do both, give it 100% on both ends.
Now, did you have temp music when you were editing? Did you? At what point did you bring in your final music?
I had you're breaking up a little bit again, but I had mostly temp music, and a lot of, there's a lot of canned music involved too from mm-hmm. people who do scores. So, but I mean, I didn't have the budget to bring in an actual somebody who could create the score from scratch.
Well, that just means you got to go do more cinematography work for other filmmakers to have the money to do that on your next film.
That's what I'm doing. I got two features I'm getting ready to do back-to-back starting next month.
Oh, my God. Do you like stepping into the director's chair?
In a perfect world, I love the director's chair, but the next project that I do for myself, I'm going to give up the cinematography ring and just do the directing. I don't like doing both. Like I said, I've had 30 years of this, but I do not like doing both because I feel you'll have a shortcoming. If I'm directing, I know my cinematography will be a little, it may have shortcomings in the cinematography mm-hmm. and vice versa. If I'm a cinematographer and I'm directing, I'm going to have some shortcomings in my directing. I can't give it 110%. Mm-hmm. I got too much going on in my head.
Now, when you're wearing multiple hats like this, cinematographer, camera operator, director, and editor, do you have anybody giving you a second set of eyes looking at things, or is it all you?
Well, I had a great assistant camera, first AC, and also a great first AD. So, and I've known these guys for a while, and, we would discuss things amongst ourselves as well. So they were looking over my back, over my shoulder as well. Especially my first AC, he was doing the same. He would say, Brian, you may want to think about blah, blah, blah. And see, we're like that. I love hearing their aspects and look, tell me your thoughts. And I said, you know what? You're right. Let's do it this way. That kind of thing. So, it was a joint effort.
Well, it worked. You pulled it off. You pulled it off.
Thank you.
For the film.
Thank you.
Now, what's the next project you're going to be working on that you can tell us about?
I'm starting a project that's pretty mind-boggling. I'm actually doing a documentary on a gentleman who, a former mafia member. He was with the Bonanno crime family.
Oh, my God.
He's the longest-running informant for the FBI. He's now out of the family, and I sat down and talked with him a couple of weeks ago, and he is so excited. I'm doing a documentary about his life.
Wow.
So I think that will be really huge.
Wow. Number one, I love mafia films, be they narratives, be it documentaries, behind the scenes, be it docudramas, because they're always such interesting characters. And,
oh, absolutely. And I'm actually getting him to pull some more characters in for me. He's making phone calls.
Oh, wow.
To pull in some other guys, too. So this is going to be really interesting, and I'm shooting his interview in 2 weeks about, you know, from his whole entire life from beginning to end.
Oh, my
gosh. And from that interview, we're going to see how the story, in which direction it's going to take.
Now, with a documentary, that's always key,
yeah,
is finding your through line. And I'd say at least 7 or 8 times out of 10, you do not know your through line in a documentary until you get into the meat of it.
Exactly.
But,
I totally agree.
The Bonanno crime family. Oh, Brian, you shot for the moon there, buddy. Wow.
Hey, it actually just fell into my lap. It fell into my lap by accident, actually. It was really weird how it happened. And I got the opportunity. I said, yes, I'm up for it. Let's do it.
Yeah, if that fell into my lap, I'd be going, yes, please. Absolutely. Wow.
So I hope a few months from now that we're have this conversation again talking about this documentary.
I would absolutely love that, Brian. Oh, my gosh. So if
that'd be cool.
You know, going back to population purge here for a minute, you know, what would be, if you had to pick the one element of the film of which you're most proud, what would it be?
Well, of course, for me personally, it's the cinematic look and the locations, because I'm biased in that because that's what I do for a living. And character moments such as Peter on the stage, kind of losing it, you know, becoming the puppet master.
Mm-hmm.
His antics, because I love to dive into the mental, the deep mental conscious of my characters like that, who play those kind of that Joaquin Phillips, I lost my train of thought. Those kind of characters, those moments is what I really enjoy directing. Those off the wall, mental, unstable characters.
Mm-hmm.
Right there with them.
And I have to say that also with Charlie in one of these real, and I'm not going to divulge to anybody where it is. You're going to have to watch and see it for yourself. But when he scares the bejeebus out of his own granddaughter, and
yeah.
we have no clue who this is.
Right.
And that was truly terrifying,
yeah,
which also speaks to your makeup artist. You've got some great makeup happening in this film that, of course, that adds with the scalpers and their faces and the masks and the makeup.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie and his makeup. And here again, that plays into your visuals. And as I said,
sure,
the visuals are so strong with this film. So, you know, you really have a great, great, great handle on visuals and bringing them to life and making them cohesive and telling a story. And you do that here. And those are just, I hope you go back to these very cool locations someday and shoot more.
Well, I hope to. I would love to do a part two or a prequel. There's been talk of doing a prequel. Now, if we can do a prequel or a part two, I would love to be able to raise enough money to really even raise it on a higher level than it is now, you know.
Mm-hmm. A prequel would be interesting.
That's what we've been thinking. We've been thinking about that.
Yeah, a prequel would be interesting, but then you might not necessarily need some of these locations because you would want to do a prequel as the decline, as we're declining into dystopia. So,
right, exactly.
Or these could be the first, you know, building blocks of the dystopian world.
Sure. Well, exactly. And if we did a part two, we could also easily pick up at the very end of our character. You know, our character who's basically walking, as you know.
Yes.
We can pick up there. Where is she going to? That kind of thing.
Because we have a bunch, we lose a lot of people, you know, unimportant scalpers and things.
Right,
but
sure.
We have some main characters that are still with us at the end. So watching that journey, and especially the one Maya's journey, I would love to see that explored.
Yeah. Oh, that's actually the idea is on the paper as we speak.
Yeah, that could prove very interesting.
That's the idea we're thinking, actually.
Oh, my. Well, Brian, this has been an absolute delight getting to talk with you about Population Purge. Everybody
really
can see it tomorrow. It's on all of the usual digital streaming suspect platforms. So, and I checked out the website. The website's really cool. Populationpurge.com.
Populationpurge.com.
Yep. And you've got all kinds of really cool little things in there, some beautiful imagery, some behind-the-scenes shots. But and if they don't know what digital platforms, other than every digital platform, will be carrying this tomorrow, you can go to the website and check it out.
Yep.
Brian,
exactly.
thank you so much. And I do hope you come back on the show again with your next project.
Oh, I will. Hopefully I will.
Well, you finish driving safely to your location, and hopefully we will talk sooner rather than later.
Awesome. That sounds good, Debbie. Thank you so much.
Brian, thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. Thank you. Bye.
And that was Brian Johnson, co-writer, director, cinematographer, camera operator, and editor of Population Purge. It's available tomorrow. All your streaming platforms. Check it out. And as I said, locations are great. The visuals. That is definitely Brian's strong suit as a filmmaker. And of course, if you haven't seen it yet, check out Boneyard. It's now in theaters. It's on VOD. It's on cable. So that one will keep you really interested. And of course, when you have 3 hours, go to the theater and see Horizon, An American Saga Part 1. You will not be disappointed at all. And next week, we've got someone else joining us, and you will probably hear my interviews next week with Guy Pearce talking The Convert, and Eric Roberts gunning for that Guinness Book of World Records. He's been in 820 film and television shows so far. I want to see Eric hit that 1,000. And I'm so excited because after all these years, Eric and I finally got to talk on the 3rd of July. And it was a lot of fun. So stay tuned. Join me again next week. Until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.